AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward.
Always streaming on the Civic Media
ABC News.
App.
I'm Mark Remillard. President Biden speaking from Vietnam as the country announced it's elevating the U.S. to its highest diplomatic relationship level.
We've elevated our cooperation directly to the Vietnamese highest tier of partnership, referred to as the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. That means the United States has strengthened our ties with another critical Indo-Pacific partner.
The administration says it's an important step in furthering American interests in the region in the face of growing Chinese influence. Desperate rescue efforts underway in Morocco after Friday's powerful 6.8 magnitude earthquake. More than 2,000 people are dead and thousands more injured and homeless. Searches continue as there might be still people alive buried under rubble. The search for an escaped convict in Pennsylvania entering a new phase as authorities now say they believe Danilo Cavalcante has access to a vehicle. Law enforcement now circulating details to law enforcement agencies nationwide. The search has been centered in Chester County, Pennsylvania. This is ABC News. A Florida man who tried to cross the Atlantic Ocean in a bizarre contraption now facing federal charges.
He was first spotted by the Coast Guard about 70 miles off the coast of Georgia. 51-year-old Raisa Pelucci trying to cross the Atlantic in a giant floating hamster wheel. He called it a hydropod and said he was on his way to England. The Coast Guard called it a manifestly unsafe voyage and told him to leave the wheel. Coast Guard reports saying Pelucci first threatening to cut himself with a knife. Next day, he said he had a bomb and was going to blow himself up. After 5 days and the arrival of two Coast Guard cutters, Pelucci fessed up, no bomb. The Coast Guard finally getting Pelucci off the wheel, charging him Tuesday with obstruction of boarding and other violations. Dave Packer, ABC News.
19-year-old Coco Gauff joining an elite club at the U.S. Open, becoming one of the youngest American women to win the tournament, but also one of the few Black American women to do so. Gauff defeated Arena Sabalenka to win the Open. This is ABC News.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A group of U.S. House Republicans wants $4 billion in cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency in exchange for their votes against a government shutdown later this month. Environmentalists say that would jeopardize efforts to eliminate PFAS pollution. Mark Richardson reports.
Betsy Sutherland, a former EPA staffer who worked on water issues, says this isn't the time to play politics with cleaning up the environment.
Budget cuts will have real consequences for EPA's ability to protect human health and the environment, not just from PFAS, but from every environmental threat our country is facing.
These chemicals are among the most persistent toxic compounds in existence, contaminating everything from drinking water to food, packaging, and personal care products. And they never break down in the environment. Neighboring Michigan has among the highest rates in the country. A bill in the House Appropriations Committee, which funds the EPA, proposes cutting the agency's budget by more than one-third in fiscal year 2024. Sutherland says if the measure is approved, EPA funding would plummet to levels unseen in three decades.
The cuts are incredibly short-sighted. 2 weeks ago, EPA released PFAS monitoring data for 2,000 drinking water systems that show multiple PFAS chemicals are in the drinking water of over 26 million people.
John Reeder with the Environmental Working Group says most PFAS emanate from the air emissions of industrial plants. He says the group's federal PFAS report card found these chemicals in all 50 states, but industrial regions like the upper Midwest had the most sites.
We hope that Congress is listening. Budget cuts for EPA, as well as DOD's cleanup program, have real consequences and would likely delay protection for millions of people exposed to PFAS.
I'm Mark Richardson. Find our 8 trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome back to this, our second hour on Morning Cannolis. It is Saturday, September 9th, 2023. Delighted to have you join me and Anya this morning as we talk about more important issues in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Right before the top of the hour break, we're talking about, once again, Georgia and the 19-defendant indictment coming out of Fulton County there. Some specifically important things having to do with where that case is going to be tried, with least respect to the former chief of staff. We talked in the previous hour about the decision made by a federal district court judge, an appropriate right decision under the rule of law that the case needs to stay in federal court and in a state court and not be removed to federal court as Mark Meadows wanted it to do. And sending the message as well to others who might seek the same remedy, they will not be successful in doing that. And right during the course of the last few moments of our previous hour, then chatting about this other major news coming out of Fulton County, that is the release by a state court judge there. His name is Robert McBurney of the Fulton County Superior Court, of the report, a 9-page report by an investigative grand jury that, again, interviewed about 75 different witnesses during the course of the past year and a half or so, focusing on what they did to try to undermine the election in Georgia and compromise the votes that were properly cast there. And the findings of this report coming out of the investigative process here, that among the recommendations for people to be indicted that were not indicted, including Lindsey Graham, a senator from South Carolina, a neighboring state there, two former senators, David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor, a couple of Trump-aligned lawyers named Cleta Mitchell, Lynn Wood, others also in that category. And so the question is, what's going on here? Why is it the investigative grand jury makes these findings, and then the indicting grand jury, again, two different grand juries here, makes a decision not to indict as recommended by the investigative grand jury here. So the answer is a number of different possibilities. Number one, it may well be, especially when it comes to some of the specifics of some of these folks, that they may in fact have been granted immunity. Maybe they're involved with some cooperation already with Fannie Willis. We know it was a long time between the return of that investigative grand jury report and the indicting grand jury returning its indictment itself. Maybe that some of those people, some of the 20 or so who are out there, are cooperating And under those circumstances, they could be charged down the road. But right now, they're not in a contested position with the DA there. And for that reason, not the subject of an indictment here. Could also be that under the description of offense conduct set forth in the indicting grand jury, undeniably authored, recommended to the indicting grand jury by Fannie Willis, that the RICO description may not have applied to everybody. We don't know exactly what the evidence is as to those other people not indicted. All sorts of strategic reasons could very well be that down the road, Fannie Willis, like Jack Smith in the federal cases, could also indict other people in yet another indictment. No doubt all those things are perhaps on the list of options that she may have down the road, but a number of different explanations for why it is we've got an investigative grand jury recommending the indictments of individuals who are not, in fact, indicted in the end. It means, in effect, that the process works, and that's the point of this discussion. It means two things. One is you've got an indicting grand jury that is looking at these things and exercising its judgment, its discretion, which is exactly what you want a grand jury to do, to win them and sift. I have said on this broadcast in the past that I happen to be an assistant U.S. attorney for many, many years, and on several occasions, the grand jury, a federal grand jury in eastern Wisconsin, came back to me and said, you know what, Mr. Santel, we're not indicting these individuals. We do not concur that there is probable cause or there's a basis upon which to return an indictment. And again, that's an affirmation of the way the system works. I would offer, again, as an understanding of what's happening in Georgia, to those people who would say that this is a process that railroads or it's a witch hunt, just the opposite. And the fact that you've got this disagreement, if you will, at least a difference of numbers in the number of people recommended to be indicted and those indicted, that the system works, it means you've got people, not prosecutors, not investigators, who are looking at this and saying, we're going to indict these, we're not going to indict these others. And then, as I've indicated, you also have a prosecutor, a state court prosecutor, who's also exercising discretion not to charge everybody with everything. That, too, is a part of the all-important assignment given to responsible people. We talked about that theory, at that concept at the top of the first hour. People who are in responsible positions required to exercise their judgment, their discretion in a responsible way. I would offer that what we're seeing here coming out of that report is the system working and a great refutation, not only by the Judge Jones in saying in the federal court that there's no there when it comes to bringing this case into federal court. There's also, by virtue of this release of the investigative report, there's an affirmation that the system is working, and that Americans across the political aisles should look at this and say, this is not political animus, this is not political animation. This is, in fact, a process that works, and indeed, that's what these reports, that's what's coming out of Georgia this past week, affirm with great clarity. Now, we have got, as always, this hour, some callers calling in. We appreciate your phone calls at 844-967-2789. You can also text Anya and me, and you can just simply go on the website, the Civic Media website, find your radio station, pull down the Morning Cannolis file, and text us. We've already got a wonderful text, which I'll get back to in just a moment or so, and we've got a couple of callers on the line about some of our discussion, presumably already this morning. I'm going to take those phone calls right at the top of this hour as well. Joe from Madison. Joe, glad to have you with us this morning. Your comment or question or observation about our commentary today.
Thanks again for all the information, particularly about the case in Alabama. And I'm sorry if I sound stupid or ignorant here, or that I wasn't listening carefully, but I guess I'm surprised and I don't quite understand why the Supreme Court would involve itself in what they did in the case in Alabama that had to do with gerrymandering, but did not participate or certainly participate in the case about gerrymandering in the state of Wisconsin. I believe it was called Gil v. Wickford, which was the one that was looking at the packing tracking and packing. That is a methodology that was used in creating on that.
And Joe, I'm going to... And Joe, if I can interrupt, I'm having a great deal of difficulty hearing you. I know you're making some reference to Alabama, but for some reason the line is a little bit garbled right now. And I'm wondering if I will take you right back up. I wonder if you might be able to either call in or again so we can get a more clarification. I think I'm following you, but I want to be very, very precise. So I'm wondering if you could call back in and we'll get you back on the line and get your question articulated with great clarity. Anya's also indicating we'll keep you on that list here and get your question back here in just a moment or so. Joe, thanks so much for that. And in the meantime, Mark also calling in this morning with a comment or question.
Yeah, thanks, James. Looking at the case down in Georgia, and then also the other news coming out of Michigan, where apparently one of the Michigan fake electors was actually caught in a interview back in 2020. This is during December, you know, right after they committed the fraud, you know, signed off on those fake documents they hope to get to the vice president, that she admitted coordination with people working for the Trump campaign. And I just can't help but think that here in the state of Wisconsin there was similar connections there, that and the hesitancy, the reticence of our state attorney general to actually open an investigation on this, especially it should be a grand jury investigation as well, because to start interviewing these people to see what contacts were made between these people and how many other people were involved in this whole thing. Because it just, you know, going back to my early career, you know, when I first got hired by the state of Wisconsin, you know, I spent, you know, a good amount of time reading the code of ethics for state employees and had to apply that during my career. And none of these people that apparently signed off on this fake electors thing actually paid attention to, and not only the law, but also the code of ethics and the implied duty you have to uphold both the letter and the spirit of the law and the Constitution. And that it's just remarkable to me that you see all the inconsistencies that are evident here now in the state of Wisconsin. I saw today an article where Sam Alito was smacking back at Congress for talking about instituting ethical rule standards for the Supreme Court, while at the same time where something that was not an ethical violation on the part of candidate Protase, which is apparently, you know, the Republicans in our legislature are going to hold that against her and bringing up a pretty much phony impeachment, what's simply to hold off the implementation of a letter of the law interpretation of our Constitution when it comes to voting districts.
Lots and lots of things to unpack there, Mark. As always, appreciate your comments and observations. I'll indicate that one of these broadcasts, we are going to get back to the Supreme Court. Indeed, there was some additional news coming out of the United States Supreme Court with respect to Sam Alito and a demand, if you will, by lots of folks in Washington, D.C., including the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, that he recuse himself in connection with a tax-related case, a wealth case, in which one of the attorneys petitioning before him, arguing case before him, was also involved in some interviews that the associate justice engaged in. That kind of thing, once again, underscores the broad issue I think that you're making, Mark, which is ethics and the need not only for an ethics code in front of before the United States Supreme Court. We've got some indication that some of the justices now are talking and saying that maybe something is in the works here, but we haven't seen that yet. That issue, however, spans beyond just the United States Supreme Court, as important as that is, and applies to everybody. Again, as I indicated at the top of our first hour, and again right now, the notion that your decisions on behalf of the people that you represent are all important. You've got to be guided by a set of rules and regulations that ensure integrity, that ensure focus on the rule of law, and that all of those kinds of things are animating you every single day of your work. Mark also indicated, of course, we've got this fake electors issue, and hopefully we'll get back to that as well, not only here in the state of Wisconsin, where to this date, our state attorney general has indicated that there may or may not be an investigation going on. But we know that not only in Michigan, but also, as Mark, you indicated, but also in Georgia, by virtue of the Fani Willis and the grand jury indictment there, you've got electors who have have been charged with engaging in state law violations in Georgia and Michigan, raising issues about other fake electors around the country, likewise, who could be the subject of state prosecutions here in the state of Wisconsin, and also in the federal system as well. Let's not forget that, too. Entirely possible that a future indictment could focus on that as well. When we come back, we'll talk about more of those kinds of issues and others right here on Morning Cannolis.
Menards has the household items you use every day at great prices. Plus, get 11% off everything. Keep your devices powered with Energizer Max batteries. They deliver consistent performance and can hold power for up to 10 years while in storage. A 16-pack of AA and AAA batteries are $8.99 after 11% off at Menards. Good through September 17th, savings are mail-in rebate. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Save big money at Menards.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
We are back. We're talking this morning, as always, about law, justice, and the aspiration for that justice here in the state of Wisconsin and in America. Some great calls, some great comments also on text coming in here through the studios of Civic Media and focusing on some of those as well. Following up on the call that Mark just made place to us and focusing in particular upon justice for all those people might be involved. I want to note that Wes, likewise, affirming that notion that other people who tried to undermine our votes here in Wisconsin should get to face a little justice, as Wes describes it in his text as well. Concur entirely. Nothing that prevents the federal government, Jack Smith, in his future indictments, and those are coming as well, from charging federally false electors and other people involved here in the state of Wisconsin and certainly in Georgia and Michigan, Arizona, Pennsylvania, the other states likewise involved in this kind of a criminal effort. Nothing that prevents the federal government, the Department of Justice, from indicting, and likely that that will happen at some point down the road. But it would offer, in connection with Mark's good comment and Wes's comment as well, that there are also some state rights to be vindicated here as well. And that's why Fani Willis has brought those charges against many, not all of the false electors there. That's why the Attorney General in the state of Michigan, Mark just made reference to that as well, also bringing charges against the people there and offer that indeed, to the extent that the facts support it and the law support it, and it does, for the most part, every single state in the United States of America has false statements charges and the kinds of things that can, in fact, prohibit precisely what happened here with respect to the fake electors. probably at the time of the passage by the legislature of the statutory prohibitions on false statements and false claims and misrepresenting things to government, didn't anticipate false electors, people putting together false documents purporting to be things that they are not. Nonetheless, again, that's what discretion of prosecutors is all about. It's identifying what the nature of the conduct has been, doing the investigation through a grand jury or separate from a grand jury, and then determining whether the existing law does, in fact, prohibit the conduct that has been identified. That's what the process of a prosecutor is all about. That's what's happening. That's what's happening in Georgia. That's what's happening in Michigan, and I'd offer as well, that's what's happening in the office of the special counsel, Jack Smith. Should also be happening, to Wes's good point, to Mark's good point, here in the state of Wisconsin, as you vindicate state interests as well that are sometimes similar to and even parallel to federal interests, but can be different. And that's what's going on, at least today, to this time, in Michigan and also in Georgia. So concur entirely on those good points Wes and Mark made about those kinds of prosecutions going on in the state system as well. Also had a reference by Dana, likewise texting in, about our prior discussion involving this Alabama matter, and in particular the decision by this three-judge panel that we talked about in our first hour, finding that the Alabama legislature had once again violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, now directing that a special master and a cartographer put together drawing lines in the state of Alabama to ensure that federal elections and state elections are consistent with the law. And Dane in particular noted, as did the United States Supreme Court and again the three-judge panel just this past week, that there are seven districts altogether. 28%, well, actually a little bit more than that, 28% of the Alabama population is black, people of color there. And so Mark does some math here and says, gosh, 28% is a lot closer to 30 than 20. Why shouldn't they, that is the, frankly, everyone in the state of Alabama, but in particular focusing on people of color, get three districts versus two in Alabama? Dana makes that good math commentary. Plainly, I'll let Dana and others do the math on that kind of a thing. But the focus, I think, Dana, of your good point is one district is nowhere near representation. Two would approach that representation, and three, if you did in fact create three districts that were majority black, that would also not only be enhancing the Voting Rights Act of the 1960s, but also ensuring that people have access. And so very good points made all around. Always appreciating your phone calls on text and also by phone at 844-967-2789 if you can't get through, or as with respect to one of our callers, Joe, this past hour, if you have problems with respect to the clarity of the phone call, text us as well. We'd be delighted to engage with you in discussion through that process as well. Lots of things to talk about here this morning on Morning Cannolis. Georgia significant, Alabama significant, and also some other things related to January 6th and the investigations and activities going on around the country. These are going to be fairly limited in nature, but it indicates, again, the amount of time and attention appropriately being given to people who engage in violations not only of our social norms, but actually of the law. You may recall well, as we commented last week, that Peter Navarro, this former economics advisor to the former President Donald Trump, going to trial just this past week for contempt of Congress. He was one of these several people who failed to provide information, cooperate in any manner with the House Committee, the House Select Committee, established by former Speaker Nancy Pelosi to investigate the January 6th riot, the insurrection of that time. That committee looking at many, many people, talking to many people, lots of different documents, items for evidence presented to that committee. Among them, Peter Navarro. Why? Because even as an economics advisor, he had particular interest in the committee based upon his frequent television appearances at the time in which he cast doubt on the election results and peddled this sort of specious claim of voter fraud
just like his boss, the former president, was doing. So this is the January 6th committee had subpoenaed him, Peter Navarro. Peter Navarro had said, nope, I'm not cooperating as well, raising the issue that his boss, the former president, had directed him not to cooperate, raising in particular the issue of executive privilege, that he didn't have to provide that information because of that doctrine. The court last week, the district court judge who's presiding over the case, Judge Abin Mehta, finding that theory does not hold water. And indeed, this past week, after a couple of days of trial and a few hours of deliberation, the trial jury finding that Peter Navarro was guilty of criminal contempt of Congress based upon his failure to appear pursuant to that grand jury subpoena. Steve Bannon, also a former strategist for Trump, as you may recall, likewise convicted of the same offense last year. Right now, he's facing 4 months in prison, remains free on appeal. The sentencing for Peter Navarro coming up in January, in front of Judge Mehta. When we come back, more information having to do with more people involved in January 6th, including John Eastman. Stay with us for that conversation.
This summer, Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK has a new starting lineup. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Tom and Crude. Then at 6, The Maggie Dawn Show. WLAK.
ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. President Biden speaking from Vietnam as the country announced it's elevating the U.S. to its highest diplomatic relationship level.
We've elevated our cooperation directly to the Vietnamese highest tier of partnership, referred to as the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. That means the United States has strengthened our ties with another critical Indo-Pacific partner.
The administration says it's an important step in furthering American interests in the region in the face of growing Chinese influence. Desperate rescue efforts underway in Morocco after Friday's powerful 6.8 magnitude earthquake. More than 2,000 people are dead and thousands more injured and homeless. Searches continue as there might be still people alive buried under rubble. The search for an escaped convict in Pennsylvania entering a new phase as authorities now say they believe Danilo Cavalcante has access to a vehicle. Law enforcement now circulating details to law enforcement agencies nationwide. The search has been centered in Chester County, Pennsylvania. This is ABC News.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
We're back here in Morning Cannolis. Thank you for continuing to listen in. Also, as always, accepting your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Thrilled to have some engagements this morning, and also taking your texts, again, through the auspices of Civic Media Online. Delighted to have that commentary and those questions presented as well. Right before the break, talking about some other players involved in the January 6th attempt to undermine the election, this conviction just this past week after a very brief jury deliberation of Peter Navarro, the former economics advisor to the former president. He now joins Steve Bannon, likewise convicted a number of months ago for the same offense, that is contempt of Congress and failure to participate in any way, to conform to show up for anything related to the investigation pursued previously by the House committee. Again, Steve Bannon facing 4 months in prison, free on appeal right now. Peter Navarro to be sentenced in January, probably, again, because these are misdemeanors, not receiving a huge amount of time, but nonetheless, a part of the effort overall to ensure that the rule of law is advanced. Another story in that area. We know as well that the Congress had referred to the U.S. Department of Justice, others, including Mark Meadows, who arguably could have been prosecuted. Again, the exercise of discretion by prosecutors here not to indict Mark Meadows and perhaps other people for their failures to engage fully with the House committee. All of that, a part of what prosecutors do when it comes to weighing and sifting decisions about who to prosecute. Just because you can charge does not mean that you should. And there are all kinds of good and decent and rule of law based decisions that go into that process, all important to reaffirm. In connection with a judicial process, a quasi-judicial process going on in California, we also know this past week that John Eastman is also on trial with a small T. He's not in a federal court, he's not in a state court, but he's appearing in front of a disciplinary panel, if you will, in the state of California. And who is John Eastman? Again, John Eastman, among the six unindicted co-conspirators set forth in the federal indictment, alleging right now the single defendant, Donald Trump, engaging in four different counts of undermining the election, compromising, attempting to compromise the vote counting on January 6th. John Eastman identified among the people who worked with the former president in accomplishing those things, almost certainly going to be indicted in the federal system. John Eastman also indicted formally by name by the indicting grand jury through Fonnie Willis in Georgia. Lots and lots of things to keep track of. He's got lots of problems as well, as do other lawyers involved. You may recall well that people like Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell also facing disciplinary proceedings in various jurisdictions. Their licenses compromised by their involvement in advocacy, for which they knew there was no support. And various panels now finding that because of their false statements, their misrepresentations, their advocacy without foundation, without an ethical base, the kind of thing that Mark was talking about before, that their licenses should be suspended, should be terminated. John Eastman in California, where he is licensed to practice law, facing debarment by a proceeding going on right now. He is testifying this past week, basically facing 11 disciplinary charges by the State Court of California, stemming from this so-called legal strategy that he, along with a fellow named Ken Chesman and Chesbro and others, designed in connection with the attempt to undermine the election. Many, many portions of Eastman's testimony this past week
affirming from his own view that he doesn't recall making statements that the vice president, for example, could reject electoral votes as a part of this process. Doesn't recall various events that he allegedly was engaged in. Did not remember seeing a lot of the things that were reported in the national media. And saying along other things that he represented during the course of this proceeding, this administrative proceeding in California, he said it never said it was a viable option. That is to have the vice president declare that some of the electoral votes presented to him in the well of the Congress were simply invalid and sending the whole thing back to state. Said, I never did that. He said, given where we ended up on January 4th, I find it implausible that I would have made that statement. Well, a lot of the evidence indicates just the opposite. It's in part the reason why he has been named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the federal indictment, certainly focusing on Georgia, one of the reasons why he is named among the 19 who were indicted there in Georgia. The panel in California, again, it's not a criminal panel, it's not a formal civil panel, but does have the authority and responsibility to determine the future of John Eastman's law license, his license to practice law in the state of California, as there are similar panels in every state, including the state of Wisconsin. All of these panels now looking at what these lawyers did to further this scheme, alleged by the special counsel, Jack Smith, also alleged now by Fani Willis in the indictment coming out of Georgia. We'll keep on top of that one as well. We also know, speaking about Jack Smith, based upon a portion of a pleading released this past week, that Jack Smith continues to be hugely concerned about the conduct out there of the former president in making statements on Truth Social, being very, very public about criticism of him, criticism of the judge and the process in general. Again, this is not criticism that is a part of the natural, normal procedure here. This is not statements by a defendant, which under the First Amendment, under our rights to freedom of speech, you can go out there and say, you know what, I didn't do this. I find that the prosecution will the defense against the prosecution will show that I did not, in fact, engage in this behavior. That's one thing, to maintain your innocence, which you've got a right to do, to maintain that you will present evidence in the course of the trial that will indicate that you're not, in fact, guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, as the prosecution may charge. This is different. And again, this past week, Jack Smith, as he and his colleagues have done before, raising as a part of a larger motion, most of which is under seal. We haven't seen all of that. But a portion of this indicates that Jack Smith, because of these continuing statements going after the judge, Judge Tanya Chutkan, and going after the prosecutor, and indicating the entire process is skewed, that is a rich hunt, the kinds of things we've heard from Donald Trump all along, that those kinds of things now are threatening to prejudice the jury pool, the future jury pool that will be selected, assembled, out of which the jury itself will be selected, repeatedly warning the judge about this process that to ensure that the integrity of the system and encouraging some remedial action here. Undeniably, Judge Chutkan has already told the defendant here, Donald Trump, that she needs to ensure that his conduct is indeed consistent with the basic standards and practices. Trump, along the way, has used his platform to call Smith, Jack Smith, deranged, and sarcastically says that he's sure that Chutkan will be very fair, that kind of statement made about the judge. Those are the kinds of things that can be the subject of sanctions. And we have talked about that before, especially since Judge Chutkan, like the presiding judge in Georgia and other places around the country, judges do this all the time to ensure that the integrity of the process is promoted. The lesson here is that, like defense counsel, their very important role in ensuring that the government is put to its proof during the course of any presentation, the prosecution also has a very legitimate and compelling interest in ensuring that the process itself is legitimate and it's based upon a jury pool that's brought in that is fair and decent. It's not impacted by these kinds of statements. That's the kind of thing that Jack Smith is now rearticulating for Judge Chutkan, letting her know, as I'm sure she does based upon her own review and her own exposure to the public media out there, that the public engagements, things said even as late as last night when the former president is in Iowa campaigning, suggesting once again that this process is something other than what it really is, which is a legitimate process to determine what happened. The presumption of innocence remains with the defendant, Donald Trump, in the federal system. It remains with all of those 19 in the state court in Georgia, brought by that investigating and now indicting grand jury, prosecuted by Fannie Willis. All of that, a part of the process that is legitimate, not the product of a witch hunt, not the product of things that the former president is articulating out there in the media. We will see what Judge Chutkan does. Again, in response to this latest reminder, if you will, by the special counsel that Donald Trump continues to engage in this kind of inappropriate and counter to the basic rule of law principles approach when he is out there speaking publicly. We have talked today already about the involvement of individuals at the mid-level, at the highest level, at the lower levels as well. We know as well that many people involved in the assault on the Capitol, about 1,100, they continue to be identified. They continue to be charged, investigated, and sentenced by the federal district court in the U.S. District in the District of Columbia. And indeed, this past week, another major event involving some of those mid-level supervisors, managers, and organizers, this one involving Enrique Tarrio. Enrique Tarrio, the ex-leader of the Proud Boys. You may recall, based upon our discussion of last week, that we spent a lot of time talking about the imposition of his co-defendants, who had been found guilty previously of seditious conspiracy, again, after a trial, before what? Before a trial jury in the District of Columbia. Four of them found guilty, as was Enrique Tarrio. We talked last week about this, the fact that Ethan Ordine was given 18 years in prison based upon his conduct. That Dominic Pozzola, the only one who was not found guilty of seditious conspiracy, given 10 years for his involvement in this conduct as well. And others, Joseph Biggs, 17 years in prison. Another key figure, Zachary Rell, giving 15 years. All extraordinary sentences under the federal guidelines. Interestingly, the judge imposing these sentences, Judge Timothy Kelly, not only finding that the enhancement under the guidelines for a terrorism conduct, domestic terrorism, should apply, but believe it or not, even imposing these extraordinary sentences in at levels that are below what the sentencing guidelines in the end would otherwise recommend. We know that the government in all these cases is recommending sometimes twice as much as these sentences are being doled out. Nonetheless, that's the process, again, that we embrace. That is, judges make decisions about how long people should be sentenced in the federal system, the state system as well. This past week, again, a judge in the federal district court in the District of Columbia imposing another sentence upon the fifth member of the Proud Boys, his name once again, Enrique Tarrio, the former leader of the Proud Boys, sentenced to 22 years in prison for his very central role in organizing this gang, this group of pro-Trump followers to attack the Capitol on January 6th of 21 and to stop the peaceful transfer of presidential power on that day. Interestingly, the evidence at trial indicated that unlike these other four defendants, again now sentenced to slightly lesser terms in federal prison, Enrique Tarrio not present in Washington, D.C. on that day. He was there the night before. A lot of the evidence presented during the course of the trial against him confirming what he said, confirming as the events took place later on January 6th that we did this, we accomplished this, is what he's saying, taking responsibility for it. But Enrique Tarrio himself in the Baltimore area, based upon directives that he not be in Washington, D.C., based upon some other conduct, some other criminal conduct in which he was engaged. In any event, the judge this past week finding once again that the terrorism, domestic terrorism enhancement applies, that this it was indeed by Enrique Tarrio a seditious conspiracy, an instance of domestic terrorism, and sentencing Enrique Tarrio to 22 years. That is the highest sentence imposed to date on anyone, including the excess of 1,000 people charged already, many of them getting much lower sentences, many of them getting sentences in the single-digit range, and as we know as well, in the double-digit range. Enrique Tarrio this past week getting 22 years in prison, the most severe sentence imposed to date. We know that Stuart Rhodes, the head of another group, they're the Oath Keepers, he getting 18 years in prison, 22 years imposed upon Enrique Tarrio. When we come back, a description and an examination of why that's important, why it's significant to promote the rule of law, and why it is that this happened this past week in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia. Stay with us for that discussion.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bride.
And apparently, Maggie Dawn, big Newton lover of the Maggie Dawn Show.
I was so offended, Jane. You know how much I love and admire you. You're like my freaking radio hero. And then to hear you bash my Newton.
It's still bad.
You want the cakey part cakey. You want the jammy part jammy. That is like bringing me back.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bride. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Welcome back. This is our final segment on this Saturday, September 9th, 2023. Morning Cannoli is talking about the imposition of the most severe sentence imposed upon anyone involved in the January 6th sedition. That sentence imposed by Judge Timothy Kelly, a federal district court judge in the District of Columbia, imposing a 22-year sentence upon Enrique Tarrio, the former leader of the Proud Boys, finding that this was not only a serious offense, according to Timothy Kelly, adding this domestic terrorism enhancement and describing Tarrio as the ultimate leader of the conspiracy motivated by a revolutionary zeal. That's words from the district court judge imposing sentence. Interestingly, in what seemed like testimony that Tarrio never gave at trial, he told Judge Kelly that after the election, he could simply not believe that Donald Trump had lost and that every media outlet he turned to told him that his anger was justified. That was his description to the imposing judge this past week. And after two pro-Trump rallies in Washington before January 6th, he went on again, all this description to the judge. He said he saw the temperature rising among his followers and claimed that he reached out to officials in the FBI, the Secret Service, and the local Washington police. And as for January 6th, however, he said that it was a national embarrassment. Mr. Tarrio, now saying it's a national embarrassment, said, "I am not a political zealot." Like his mother, who also testified, asking for leniency, Tarrio likewise asking for leniency in this case. As he left the courtroom, escorted by federal marshals, Tarrio raised two fingers in a peace or a victory sign. That happened again this past week in the federal district court in front of Judge Timothy Kelly, 22 years, against people who were involved in organizing, directing. No indication that Tarrio himself, of course, was in the Capitol engaging the violent conduct, but receiving the strongest sentence. Why? By virtue of the conspiracy that he put together with himself and others. That's the nature of a conspiracy to undermine what happened, what was going to happen, trying to undermine what was going to happen on January 6th, and accomplishing it in a way that compromised the very nature of who we are as a nation. That's the reason why Judge Kelly said that you are at the core of this revolutionary zeal, and that's the reason why he gets 22 years in prison. Again, nowhere near what the government had requested, focusing upon the impact that you can have even as a supervisor and organizer in doing these kinds of things. A very significant sentence. We will see what happens to other people, again, among the excess of thousands of people already charged, awaiting sentencing in this process overall. We'll see what happens, again, not only to the former president, now charged in the federal system, and also in the state system as well. All of that coming up as we go ahead with our further examination, our discussion of that. Promise as well, down the road, to return to that federal indictment. I want to talk in great detail, do a deeper dive into some of the specific allegations that are also a part of that indictment coming out of the federal system that focuses upon the way in which the Department of Justice, through a former senior leader named Jeffrey Clark, the attempts to try to undermine the work, the mission of the Department of Justice in accomplishing that, and then also the involvement of the attempt to involve the former vice president. All of that set forth in that indictment as well. We'll get back to that in a future broadcast to further describe the nature of these charges. Again, affirming always that defendants are assumed presumed innocent until proven guilty, but showing in depth and detail the nature of the charges that are pending right now against the former president. As we head into our last minute, we do have another caller, Kevin, calling in from Appleton. Kevin, glad to have you with us this morning.
Hi, good morning.
Glad to have you with us, Kevin.
Trump would, yes, thank you for taking my call. Do you think if Trump becomes president, if he does, would he pardon those folks that were sentenced?
Kevin, great question. And let me answer it as directly as you've stated it, not only based upon the authority of a president, but also upon what Donald Trump himself has said out there. He plainly continues in social media and publicly rallies those kinds of things to say that he views all of these prosecutions as illegitimate. He describes a lot of the people who are involved in the January 6th on-the-ground insurrection. Anybody who's even touched this, certainly the people around him, the unindicted co-conspirators in the indictment that he is facing, the other 18 in Georgia. He regards all of this as a witch hunt, as foundationless and the product of political animus. Highly, highly anticipating that if he does become president, he would pardon those who are charged in the federal system and who have been the subject of prosecutions already. Could also pardon people who have not been charged. Significantly, to answer your very good question, the reason why the state prosecution in Georgia, state prosecutions that may come in Michigan, certainly the New York prosecution, the criminal prosecution there, not for January 6th, is also a very important prosecution, is because those are not subject to a federal pardon by a federal president, but he could do it. And as we've talked before, under our Constitution, written by James Madison, adopted by our states, the power of the president to impose pardons on people is, in fact, plenary. It's very, very broad, and he could do that highly likely. Can't predict with certainty, but highly likely if Donald Trump does become the next president of the United States of America, that he will establish a process and will grant pardons to all of these folks who have been the subject of these prosecutions. Importantly, it's a wonderful Supreme Court case out there that Jerry Ford carried around in his pocket ever since, throughout his entire life, certainly during the term of his presidency, that says that whenever you accept a pardon, you're also accepting, you're acknowledging guilt. And that's something that's also a part of our jurisprudence. The Supreme Court has said just that. But to your very good question, yes, indeed, the president does have the power to not only confer pardons upon individuals who are out there, convicted, sentenced, charged, appeals can, in fact, be exhausted, and can also, as Jerry Ford did with Richard Nixon, grant a pardon for conduct not yet charged, not yet the subject of litigation. So, again, one more reason to think long and hard about what happens in about 14 months from now when we elect the next president and determine what America means for us and the rule of law. As we close today, I want to also acknowledge that we've been playing today the wonderful music of Jimmy Buffett. And we know that Jimmy Buffett was lost to all of us, a great artist in America just about a week or so ago. As we leave today playing the release from the Jimmy Buffett group of songs released posthumously in celebration of his life and the artistry that he brings to America. We recognize not only that he is lost to us, but that his legacy endures musically and in terms of artistry throughout our nation. Join us again next week for more discussion, not only of the rule of law, justice, and government, but also about ways in which we can all become involved in ensuring that America remains the country that enforces, that observes, and exalts the rule of law in all that we do. Thanks for joining me this morning. Have a good week, everybody. Take care.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts.
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic Media
ABC
app.
News.